very much for including chemistry on the programme in this conference, and it's very nice to brush up a special place. What I'm going to do in my talk is discuss, give you what I think are some plausible imminent reasons to be a microstructural essentialist about chemical substances. So if I'm going to do that, I need to tell you what microstructural essentialism is, what it does and doesn't claim. I've also got to tell you what chemical substance is. That turns out to be an important distinction, but some objections to essentialism literature are simply they're not talking about things which are chemical substances. And I want to do that in a way. I've also got to tell you what a microstructure is, because that's what nobody's really kind of thought about that. Because what you have to do, Paul gave us a challenge in the 2000 paper. He said, well, what is a microstructure of water? I will give you an answer to that. Paul might not accept it as a microstructure. I don't necessarily think of a microstructure as something which is, as it were, synchronic. It's a dynamical thing. That's what I think water is, and that's how I think chemistry thinks about microstructures and how they give rise to the stuff we see around us and their distinctive kinds of behaviour. And I see the notion of, I think of the notion of a structure, that is, so when I say a microstructure, I don't mean just something like when Peter Fanning Morgan talked about arrangements. I mean, you know, what chemists mean by structure. They mean ways elements are combined together at the molecular scale. So it's got a particular scale, and it's got particular levels of abstraction which are appropriate to understanding the sameness and difference relations between chemical substances. So that's what I'm going to do. I see this as kind of arising, these ideas of substance and structure, as arising from a compositional research program which was began with Lavoisier, where we hit on his list of simple substances, gives you a project which is, let's look at the stuffs around us and let's try and find which elements they've got in them. And the residue, that gives you a place to look for more elements. And you get this growing list of elements. Many of them were metals in the early part of the 19th century. I think that's a very crucial thing. A notion of structure just comes along necessarily then, not a priori, but because you're presented with a particular explanatory problem, that there are these things called isomers. Isomers are distinct chemical substances which contain the same elements in the same proportions. So, if they contain the same elements in the same proportions, then you must think that the same elements are combined in different ways, the same proportions but in different ways. So that's what a structure is, it's a way. It's a way something is at the molecular scale. So if you want to think of a structure, it's a mode, you might think of it in metaphysical terms, as a mode. So when I start talking about the essence of water, one shouldn't think of the essence of water as a molecule. It's not a thing. It's a way something is at the molecular scale, which gives rise to its observable behaviour. Okay, so there's the foundation. So I said, so I'm going to define chemical substance, I'm going to define microstructure, I'm going to say what microstructural essentialism is, and then I'm going to give you an imminent argument for microstructuralism, and then I'm going to go from microstructuralism to microstructural essentialism. Okay, so what is a chemical substance? Well, the first thing, to be clear, is that not any kind of stuff is a chemical substance. This is one thing that many people in the literature on chemical substances just don't seem to get. Milk is not a chemical substance. Wool is not a chemical substance. Concrete is not a chemical substance. They're not. Well, why? Well, one way to look at it is sort of a bit of disciplinary balkanization. Who tells you what's milk? That's biologists, because it's a particular thing that's secreted by animals of various kinds to feed their young. Nobody would expect that to be homogeneous from a chemical point of view. You can ask chemists to come along and analyse. In this project, chemistry becomes what David Knight called a service science. It helps you find out what's in milk, which chemical substances are in milk, and then that gives you a part of the explanation about how milk in some particular case does what it does. Which are the chemical substances? Well, there's oxygen, gold, water, the things we're familiar with from the philosophical literature. Not so familiar, ethane and benzene. Okay. So, chemical substances, we assume that they are in some way homogeneous. There's some kind of structural account of what they are and how they do what they do. Other kinds of stuff, we assume that there was no particular explanation. So, one thing is that there's a perspectival thing. Chemical substances are stuffs viewed from the point of view of chemistry. They are, as it were, components of the stuffs we see around us, which one would expect in any particular case are going to be impure, especially if we're an 18th century chemist like Lavoisier. Here's another point, so this is connecting with Paul's talk. Thermodynamic criteria are clearly relevant to what gets judged as a chemical substance rather than as a mixture. But I would claim that thermodynamic criteria are non-essential. So it is metaphysically possible, so I'll defend this claim if you like, it's metaphysically possible for something to be water without displaying water's usual thermodynamic behaviour. And I don't mean this just in the sense in which Hasok Chang says that sometimes things behave anomalously. Water doesn't boil at its boiling point. I mean that there are clear cases where chemists reason about stuff as if it's water on the basis of its composition, by it being made of water molecules, but this is in a nomologically different worlds in which it has a different thermodynamic behaviour. So it's non-essential. The thermodynamic behaviour is not part, from a chemist's point of view, I believe, thermodynamic behaviour is not part of what makes water what it is. So what is a microstructure? Well, as I said, the idea of a structure comes about as part of a compositional research programme to answer certain conceptual foundational problems in 19th century chemistry. To distinguish isomers, you have to identify these ways and start reasoning about these ways in which you may be able to make predictions and so on. First thing, so here's my desiderata. I think a structure is an abstraction. It's a way of attending to some feature that something has and ignoring other ones. Familiar from Locke in the way, particular way that John Hart's taken it up as partial consideration. I'm looking at this, I don't care about that. So I'm looking at agreement and neglecting disagreement. The second point is that matter is always in motion. That this is something we know from quantum mechanics tells us that this is nomologically necessary because even at absolute zero, there are zero point motions which make a difference to the behaviour of stuffs at the molecular scale. So one thing one should take away from that is that the talk of arrangements that one finds in the literature on the special composition question is literal nonsense. So when someone tells you that a meteorological nine can give you a paraphrase, no, they can't. Or at least, if they can, they can't guarantee that it doesn't have a commitment to the existence of, say, for instance, chairs. Because they have no separate account of what an arrangement is. So that's an aside. And it's clear that in chemistry, the microstructure of a substance essentially involves the elements of which it's composed in particular proportions, which are, these are individuated by the nuclear charges, and secondly, the ways in which they're combined. Then these ways are the structures. So here's an example, ethane, give you an idea of the kind of abstraction involved. Ethane can be thought, quoting from a marvellous book by, I can't remember his first name now, Bassendale, anyway. Chemistry in Three Dimensions, marvellous book in so many ways. It's just lots of lovely diagrams and things. Ethane can be thought, it's got these marvellous, ethane can be thought of in terms of two linked CH3 propellers with each CH3 rotating rapidly. Now, the thing is, the important thing is they don't rotate without restriction because you can see the form on the left there, that's the Newman projection looking at the molecule end on, as it were. The hydrogens are offset. That's a lower energy state than the state in which they are eclipsed. So those ones are supposed to be right eclipsing each other. So if you look at this thing, these things rotating around, it can be going through a series of things like this. And there's the eclipse, and there's the offset state. So there's a bump. It's not just simply, it's not free rotation, it's ba-dum, 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 just like going over a series of very small speed bumps. Okay, so there's two different representations. Now, what's in common, so we've got two different conformations there, eclipse and offset. What's in common to those two structures? Well, that's what ethane is. It's the bond structure. And the bond structure, just in case anybody thinks of bonds, that's a bit 19th century chemistry, how does that fit into quantum mechanics? We know that there's a problem. I can give you an account, if anybody wants, of what the bond topology of a molecule is in quantum mechanical terms. That's quite easy since various developments in DFT and applications of it by Bethe, so these kinds of problems, but we can talk about that. Secondly, what's a microstructure? So again, we're going to have the abstraction going on, but here we get, a historical dynamical element to what stuffs are. Paul has asked in his 2000 paper, what is microstructure? Sorry, that's not actually a quote, that's me paraphrasing. And the problems are, as he pointed out in his talk, that water is actually heterogeneous at the molecular scale, so it's got various different kinds of things in it. But the important thing about it, what's common to every sample of pure water, is the fact that you could make it by bringing together some H2O molecules and allowing them to interact. And that interaction is a particular kind of interaction which the H2O molecules are, as I've said in a previous paper, they're ingredients. Some of them go out of existence. So we have this case of self-ionization there. If we can see two H2O molecules get together and they make one of them gets protonated and leaving a hydroxyl ion. Well, regard that as part of water. It's part of that community of H2O molecules. And the point is not, so we go back to Maxwell and his assumption. I'm sorry, that's simply wrong. That's not how macroscopic substances are made by bringing together molecules at the molecular scale. So we just have to simply reject that, set it aside, and not have it as a constraint on how we think about the microstructures of substances. So consequences of this is that it does allow us some, as it were, modal flexibility in the macroscopic behaviour of water. So Putnam was right in a sense, I'm not sure, because I think it's just too far from the actual world for me safely to reason about it, whether water could have been a pink solid at room temperature. That's one example. But chemists certainly seem to have agreed that water might have had a much lower boiling point, because supposing it hadn't had any hydrogen bonding. They seem to have opined that would still be water, it would still be H2O molecules getting together, they're just interacting in a weaker way. Okay, so then I move on to natural kinds, essentialism and realism. So sometimes when one comes out as an essentialist, as it were, people think you're an essentialist about everything. But look, let's start with a permissive conception of natural kinds. Ian Hacking's got a nice paper about it. He said, okay, those metaphysicians have tried to take over the notion of a natural kind. Let's resist, well, he says, oh dear, they've spoiled it, let's give up on the notion of a natural kind. I say, no, it's our term, it's a philosophy of science term. A natural kind is anything about which science can make reliable inductive inferences. John Stuart Mill gave us the notion, thank you very much, I'll keep it. You talk about what you like, and I'll do what. I would like these foundational questions to be empirical questions. So you start with a weak definition, and then you have an empirical thing which involves lots of detailed science. I don't want, like Brian Ellis, to stipulate what a natural kind is in ways that mean that it comes out, as it were, or as a consequence of as a natural kind that essentialism is true. So what is essentialism? Well, I think essentialism is a particular kind of explanation of the fact that some particular science can make reliable inductive inferences about some particular kind in that particular case. One that appeals to a property or properties which is or are necessary and sufficient for membership of that kind. So, note that defending microstructural essentialism about one kind is quite independent of making the same claim about another kind. So that's the so one could, if one to give a fancy name to that last principle, that would be I would call it metaclassificatory pluralism. Okay, which sounds terrible, but anyway, Okay, and then finally there's realism. Realism is the claim that, well, once again, I don't think one should, as it were, assume the truth of realism in defining what a natural kind is. I'm happy for there to be all sorts of kinds which are, as it were, response-dependent and so on, natural. If we can make inferences about them, they're natural enough. It's just, the question is, how deep is the explanation? How metaphysical is it? Does it involve the interactions between the knowers and the members of the kind, perhaps even knowers themselves, and so on. So, a realism is the claim that some particular kind can be known independently of knowing what that kind is. And that's realism because then that opens up the possibility that you can know the kind and then discover what makes things have that kind. So you can say its essence has been discovered. It doesn't entail that you can that is the right account in any particular case, but it leaves it open. So the classic case there would be oxygen. So I think that Lavoisier knew about oxygen, but he didn't know what it was, because he didn't really, he wasn't committed to atomism, and therefore he wasn't committed to nuclei, and then he wasn't committed to nuclear charges, but it's having a nuclear charge of 8 that makes something oxygen. Okay, so defending microstructuralism, so I've got 3 imminent arguments. That's just arguments that are based in chemistry itself rather than imposing any external perspective from either epistemology or metaphysics. Chemistry uses microstructural properties and relations as the basis for its systematic nomenclature through the International Union of Pure Nuclear Chemistry. So if you take, does everyone know the Muppets in 1970s? And a figure called Crazy Larry. And someone would say, hey, blah, 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 this show's going like a bomb. He'd say, bomb? Yeah, come on. So I always feel like when I draw this structure, which is that's TNT. So that takes the thing. So why is it TNT? Because it's 2,4,6 trinitrotoluene. This is toluene. This is named, the TNT is the non-systematic, now being regarded as a non-systematic name. We now call it 2,4,6 trinitro methyl benzene. Because this toluene here is methyl benzene. And the systematic, like Lavoisier, the systematic nomenclature of chemistry wants to build the structure of a substance into its name so it can be read off just like Lavoisier said. Should be elementary. So here it is, 3 nitro groups. So counting out from there, there's 1, 2, 4, 6. Simple, 2, 4, 6 trinitrotoluene, hence TNT. And you can do this for lots of substances. In fact, there are 3 separate nomenclatures. We can go into that. But they're all microstructural. Microstructural, that's point, one point. Microstructural properties and relations are central to explaining chemical and physical properties, for instance, interactions with radiation, reaction mechanisms, and so on. And then the third one, I call Tina. That's after a nickname that Margaret Thatcher had when, back in the 1980s, was given by her cabinet, because she said there is no alternative. So my claim would be that there isn't another alternative way of thinking about how chemistry individuates substances, which is in fact in tune with how chemistry in fact distinguishes substances. So the main candidates here would be, I should mention Paul's favourite candidate, thermodynamics. I think there's 3 approaches. I've got a paper on this going back to 2010. But I think there are 3 approaches within thermodynamics for distinguishing substance. It's an elegant theory if you could do it, because it gives you a criterion of sameness of kind. So that would then, you know, a la Frege, you could just, if Frege uses the equivalence relation of equinumerosity to divide up the world, the set theoretic universe into equivalence classes, which you can then regard as the numbers. Take all the stuff around us. Think of thermodynamics as providing a criterion of sameness of substance, which divides the world up into the world of substance samples into equivalence relations, which would equivalence classes, which would constitute the extension of all the various kinds. I don't know whether that was Paul was what Paul was thinking of. I thought that was a very elegant way of thinking about what might be going on in the in the account. But I don't think, I'll refer a reason I won't go into because it's you've got to get into thermodynamics. I don't think any of those ways works. They work, they can give you a way of doing it, but they're more like, they tend to give you multiple ways of doing it, in particular the phase rule does. In other cases, they divide substances more finely than chemistry has chosen to. And in fact, give you some quite anomalous results. They fail to distinguish between chemical substances as continuants and their physical states as things which those continuants take on and slough off. Okay, so there's, so defending microstructuralism, here's three objections. Some substances are heterogeneous at molecular scale, so I've already really covered this one. For example, water, you know, it's a bad example. Paul's absolutely right to that. So the answer to that is that every part of water is water. OH minus iron is water if it's there in the right proportions and so on. There is some, because of what Paul said, there is some, as it were, indeterminacy over which part. So you imagine taking some sodium hydroxide and you add it to some water. So the sodium hydroxide and the water are giving a certain amount of hydroxyl ions. It is in fact indeterminate. But I mean, there's lots of reasons why we've got to live with indeterminacy. It's not just that. About which particular things are, in any particular case, is, as it were, the water. I mean, the same thing happens if you take some sodium and chlorine and let them react in the normal way. The sodium loses an electron, net electron, but there's no fact to matter out which electron it is, and so on. So you can't, as it were, pair up the electrons with the elements. Fine. That's just what happens. There are some stuffs or types of stuffs for which microstructuralist essentialism cannot account. So if we go back to milk, wool and concrete, okay, fair enough, can't be microstructural essentialism. I don't think we should be microstructural essentialists about milk, wool and concrete. Fine. But what we need is a chemical substance. Thirdly, microstructuralism is reductionist. This is something that's sometimes said. Well, in one sense it is, because you say, well, a chemical substance is individuating one from the other by virtue of microstructural properties. And clearly, that means that from a very strong metaphysical point of view, if you take away all the microstructural properties, there's nothing left in the chemical substance. So you get what is the physical exhaustion. But that's a very weak claim. That's a very weak claim, and here's how weak it is. You can find John McCrane endorsing that claim in his 1993 book, and you get Tim Crane and Hugh Mellor in their famous paper, There Is No Question of Physicalism. They endorse it too. So that's a pretty weak claim. And it's perfectly compatible, so, and I won't go into this because it's like a heaving, creaking piece of Hendry construction. Microstructuralism is, I argue, compatible with chemical substances having strongly emergent properties, and that, which is kind of what you would expect if they have some variability in their macroscopic behaviour, microstructural behaviour in different possible worlds under different laws. So the laws are a different context. So you can't be a gnomic necessitarian, yeah, if you take that view, but once you, as it were, give yourself that freedom, you can see different gnomologically possible worlds as different contexts in which things might do different things, and that gives you the kind of modal room to be a strong emergentist like a board under my particular interpretation, which not very many other people who look abroad agree with. Anyway. And then how do we go from microstructuralism to microstructural essentialism? I've got 4 minutes left. Well, one, the classic way, of course, is the semantic route. So the idea there is you've got a vernacular with where words are like water. They have an extension, along come the scientists, and the extension is used with the intention that it's the word water will refer to whatever future scientists will identify as water, so they're given this role, this deference. That assumes that the word has got an determinate extension and that there's no kind of precisifying or cleaning up on the way through in the empirical business. And that's problematic in so many ways. Partly there's a quay problem. So one fact is, it's fairly clear from empirical literature and linguistics that the phenomenon of deference doesn't really exist. It's not at all clear that, taken from the chemist's point of view, that the way that speakers of English use the word water collectively has any extension. It doesn't mean that they can't use the word water to refer to particular bodies of water, but so there's a nice paper by Barbara Malt on this. In these instances, that seemed to be a real problem. It's a quay problem. Deference doesn't exist. It does not clear that vernacular languages have got an extension for their substance names. And then fourthly, it doesn't do a job. This is goes back to Salmon. It's basically a metalinguistic approach, not a metaphysical approach. So it's not going to give you what you want. You say, well, what they find out is what microstructurally is in the extension of these things, and it doesn't tell you why that's what makes that stuff what it is. That question is left open. So then we move on to scientific essentialism, and we'll put that in inverted commas because I don't think there's anything scientific about it. In which, for instance, Brian Ellis assumes that natural kinds are discrete, hierarchical, and interest-dependent. So I've got another paper arguing that substance names are, or substance kinds, are neither discrete, hierarchical, nor interest-dependent. So it's like a triple failure there. And so that approach is simply not helpful to chemistry. I mean, it's fine if you're talking about protons or something like that. But luckily, there's another kind of more explicitly physical, metaphysical way. Harry's way, Harry Stottle is a composite figure who's got some views in common with a famous ancient Greek philosopher. And just let's take this view. It's metaphysically necessary that the only way to bring into being a sample of a chemical substance is to bring into being an instance of its microstructure. So that's how you do something which performs, as it were, wateriness. There is no other way, according to the chemists, that's what they keep fixed. And one might say, following Locke as well, and this being Durham, you must never go through a whole talk without mentioning both Locke and Aristotle. After Locke, for chemistry, the structure of a substance at the molecular scale is its very being, whereby it is what it is, and one might add, does what it does in the actual world. So I think on that point, thank you very much.